No, you're not going to see any Merkin Muffy parades or Josiah Bartlett, but real presidents, President's Day, George Washington's birthday. President's Day morning, Joe Thomas in the morning here in a town where, well, being president is kind of important to us, unless you're the folks who want to take Thomas Jefferson statues down. And really, I mean, when they start taking Abraham Lincoln's name off schools, all bets off. I'm sure at some point Richard Milhouse Nixon High School in California is going to get it too. Joining us on the program, I heard him last week on with Charlie Kirk, and I said, I've got to talk to this guy. The book is called Dragon Slayers. Larry Schweikert. Larry, thank you for taking some time out with us. Happy President's Day for somebody who's written somewhat extensively on presidential history. How are you doing this morning?
Great. You know, the subtitle of Dragon Slayers, for those who think, what does this have to do with presidents, is Six Presidents and Their War with the Swamp. And I look at Lincoln, Grover Cleveland, Teddy Roosevelt, JFK, Reagan, and Trump in their battles with different types of swamps over the course of 200 years of American history.
Well, yeah, and five of them seem straightforward, and I want you to tell us why you picked Grover Cleveland, though, because I think most of us can grasp the other ones, and I want to get into it, but what made Grover Cleveland make this list of the six?
Well, interestingly, Grover Cleveland is probably the one who most epitomizes what the book is about, because he faced the spoils swamp. After the Civil War, the spoils system, which President Martin Van Buren, as a young state legislator in New York, had set up as a means to protect and preserve slavery. I don't know how many people out there know this, but the Democrat Party was created to protect and preserve slavery. That the spoil system he created grew slowly before the Civil War, because with every election you had to promise jobs to your supporters in order to get elected.
Sure, yeah.
But after the Civil War, it just literally exploded, because you had things like the Grand Army of the Republic and other veterans, pension claimants, and all of a sudden people who never fought in a war in their lives were claiming injuries. And so by the time you got to Cleveland, and he wasn't the first, Chester Arthur had promised to reform this, and he was killed for it. He was assassinated. And his vice president, Chester Arthur, who was thought to be big on spoils, actually turned out to be a pretty good person to try and reform the system, but he was only in for 4 years. So Cleveland comes in, and Cleveland takes cutting down the size of government and all of the claims on government seriously, to the point that he literally stays up every night reviewing individual claims.
Wow.
And vetoing most of them.
That's impressive. When you talk about this, and in so much of the history, and we talk about it here, we have folks like Harry Byrd, who was a state senator, wound up in the U.S. Senate, but he was the shepherd of most of the Dixiecrats, and a lot of our Jim Crow legislation helped usher horrific laws like the Virginia Act for Sterilization in 1924, saying that if you were poor and on public assistance because you were black and we wouldn't let you work anywhere, we could sterilize you. I mean, it's just chilling. And then the Supreme Court upholds it as somehow constitutional. And somebody asked me once, of all the historical figures I would speak to, who would it be? I think it was based on something that was said during the Super Bowl. I said, well, Oliver Wendell Holmes, mainly. And the interviewer said, why? I said, because I want to ask him what in God's name made him think the Virginia Act for Sterilization was constitutional.
Right.
But we watch in the Reconstruction South, we see a lot of this cronyism. So, you know, now when you talk about this spoils system, you add that to the Reconstruction and the crony capitalism of federal, you know, construction projects, and you see where all this really metastasizes, don't you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And the thing that people don't understand is every time government says it's going to reform something, it makes it worse. And so in 1887, pushed by Cleveland, they wanted to reform the spoil system so that presidents, I mean, literally there were a line of claimants out Abraham Lincoln's door, White House door, inside the White House, all the way down the street, of people wanting jobs from the president while he's trying to fight a war.
Jeez.
And so Cleveland gets behind this Pendleton Act to try and reform this. And it does away at the time with about 13-15% of all of the jobs that were directly awarded by a president. And then over time, I don't know what it is today, but it's got to be 75-85% of all federal jobs are no longer awarded by the president. I think he has like 3,000 appointees when he comes in. And what the Pendleton Act did was it nationalized it. So instead of politicians having to promise 100 jobs here and 100 jobs there to people they actually knew, they had to start promising big groups of jobs to lobbying groups, like whether it's the NRA or the Wildlife Federation, sure, or you know, McDonnell Douglas or whoever it
Teachers
is.
Teachers unions, yeah.
Exactly. And so that ratcheted up the number of jobs that changed hands in every election by tens of thousands. And that's where you really start to see the government explode in growth. You know, you mentioned Jefferson. Jefferson answered the White House door himself in his bathrobe and slippers.
Now, I would have loved to have been there for that. But people used to do that. What is it, the big block of cheese day? Who was the president that put out cheese in the lobby of the White House? And
oh, yeah, yeah. I'm sorry. This slips my mind, but I know what you're talking about. Yeah, exactly. You know, and people came into the White House Let me repeat that a third time. Into the White House. They don't get arrested and thrown in jail.
Yeah.
They came into the White House on Jackson's inauguration, drank the liquor cabinets dry, and Jackson had to flee out the back and go have dinner by himself in a local inn, you know.
The role of the president has changed so much. Secret Service wouldn't have allowed that at all, would they? Larry Schweikert, author of Dragon Slayers. Hang on with us this President's Day morning on Joe Thomas in the Morning.
The original social media. Call Joe Thomas in the Morning on anything.
What are you?
Really?
I'm Batman.
Seville 107.5 and 1260 WCH.
A more perfect union. To ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
It's Washington's birthday. Out of laziness, we've kind of made it every president's holiday. To that, though, Larry Schweikert spending some time. We're visiting with Larry Schweikert, historian, runs, I don't know if you run or if you're, there are other folks contributing to Uncover DC as well, but we're talking about his book, Dragon Slayers, and the six presidents and their battle with the swamp. And you mentioned Grover Cleveland, but you mentioned Chester Arthur and the assassination. There's a commonality with the other five, Lincoln, Kennedy, Reagan was shot at and attempted assassination. And I throw Trump in here because for once they said, you know, it might be better if we do a character assassination, because if he actually gets assassinated, then we sort of deify him. After that, and they so thoroughly assassinated his character during his 4 years that I would throw him into the bunch, you know, who were the victim of an assassination.
Joe, that a guy rushed on stage during the campaign. He wasn't president yet, but he was the candidate in Ohio. I don't know if you remember that. And the Secret Service took the guy down. He was within 2 or 3 feet of Trump.
Oh, that's right. Gosh, that's so long ago. But it seems like they don't have any compunction with saying, hey, this is just one guy. I think about Lincoln and the fact that he had only halfway finished Jefferson's plan for mitigating slavery. Jefferson wrote eloquently that you couldn't just end slavery with the stroke of a pen without coming up with some way for folks who had for generations not been allowed access to the economy to catch up a little bit.
Well, and here's the issue with Lincoln on that. I'm very much a Lincoln fan. In my list of presidents, he's number two behind Washington, and Reagan's number three.
Great list.
You know, Cleveland's probably number four, Coolidge number five, and Trump's up there in the top 10. If he serves a second term, he may make the top five. But what Lincoln, his problem was this. He defined the war as a rebellion, and he never did call the Southerners traitors, because he wanted to bring them back into the Union as quickly and peacefully as possible. And well into 1862, he still thought that might be possible. Mm-hmm. And that's when he finally came to the conclusion, nope, we're going to have to free all the slaves. By then it was too late. And so had he declared declared all the Southerners traitors, and of course later you can say, all right, here's what you have to do to get your citizenship back, you know, say Mary had a little lamb three times and you're a citizen again. But by not doing that, he couldn't legally, constitutionally go in and take the land from the slaveholders and distribute it in his plan for 40 acres and a mule. He, in essence, he hamstrung himself constitutionally from the outset of the war.
Well, wasn't that kind of what drove the Dixiecrats to set up the assassination, though, was that they were convinced that the 40 acres and a mule were still going to come from them rather than trying to find other lands? And we still had so much of the country undeveloped at that point. And again, I point to Jefferson saying, well, he failed a second time. Once he'd made the Louisiana Purchase, he could have very easily just ended slavery there and said, we're setting up, you know, in Louisiana, right, or Arkansas or something, that, and he didn't do it again.
Metropotamia, as he wanted to call one of those states.
he might have needed to run that past his PR team. But, you know, that's where we keep swinging and missing at this, and it feeds the narrative of these 1619 Project people. I've said on the air the black population has been done worse by two presidents, and they're ironically both named Johnson, Andrew Johnson post Lincoln, and then Lyndon Johnson in the post Kennedy and his Great Society have done more damage to the black community and their efforts to break out of that than I think anyone. And I don't know if you have a bottom five list, but they've got to be on there, Larry.
Yeah, well, I mean, you start with the current Rutabaga in office, and then you move.
Hey, I lived in Delaware. He was our Senator Rutabaga for a long time, and he wasn't all that much different then. So,
well, by the way, if you go to my daily, let me put in a plug here for Today's News, the news of today's the history of tomorrow.
Yeah,
I do
great.
A column on Uncover DC, uncoverdc.com, 5 days a week. And I just read the headlines and make a snarky comment on video. And then the full stories are linked below. But I also have nicknames that I use, a nicknames list. And the Demented Pervert Bite Me is also known as the Rutabaga. And you've got McConnell is Yertle. And you've got nice. You've got Nancy Pelosi's Botoxic and so on and so forth.
Sure.
So anyway, yeah, you have these two presidents and Johnson. Is probably both Johnsons are probably in the bottom five with Obama, Carter, and the Rutabaga.
You know, Larry, I've got to run to the news here, and we've got a bunch of emails on the convoy, and we'll get into those as well and talk a little bit more about these dragon slayers that fought the swamp for us in the presidency on this president's morning. No celebrations of Merlin Mufke, was it Mufke from Doctor Strangelove or any of those folks? No President Stanton, none of the fictional ones. Sorry, Josiah Bartlett fans, though you were a real signer of Declaration of Independence, you weren't a real president, so this isn't your day anyway. I'm still waiting for Supreme Court Justice Day or member of the U.S. House of Representatives Day. I thought we were co-equal. But again, come back with Larry Schweikert in a moment here on the book. It's Dragon Slayers, Amazon. Grab the book there and pick it up and enjoy it because it's a good look at the people who fought the swamp and at varying points of success.
Being tuned in means Joe Thomas now, Sean Hannity at 3, Seville 107.5 and 1260 WCHV.
Joe Thomas in the morning. Like I said, we have lots to get into. The city wants to tax UVA. Ukraine and the separatist rebels and Emperor Palpatine of Russia facing off with Jar Jar Binks of the United States. All of that going on, plus the reaction, the Ottawa crackdown, difference between that and the Chaz Chop Summer of Love Zone of Portland. Was it Portland, Seattle? Or they were just, or even Occupy Charlottesville. How many weeks were they allowed to defile that park? And funny, they never complained about Robert E. Lee's statue then. But it is President's Day. We've reconnected. Larry Schweikert, great book. It is called Dragon Slayers, Six Presidents and Their Battles with the Swamp. Larry, and when last we were on about a half hour ago, we were talking about the failings of Reconstruction, Jefferson's plan for ending slavery, and all this stuff adds up to all of the narrative, I think. You know, that makes the case for these 1619 Project people. Don't you see that?
It feeds, Larry, as a historian, it feeds this narrative of the Ibram X. Kendis of the world. And I had the joy a few years ago of actually doing a television piece with him where he had me in this jury of people. And I was told it was going to be equally split conservatives and left-wingers. And it turned out I was the only one speaking up saying, mm-hmm. hey, you realize all the stuff you're saying is racist. And I was told, no, it's not. Black people can't be racist. I'm like, it sure as hell sounds like they are. I just, but this is what feeds this reparational narrative of today.
True, and I do believe that had Lincoln lived, he would have instituted either 40 acres and a mule or Homestead Act for nothing down, and you pay the government back later for any black freedmen who wanted it. But let me say something on the 1619 Project. It's so totally flawed, and I don't want to get into the, you know, blacks can't be racist kind of nonsense. The problem with the 1619 Project is it's looking at the wrong place.
Mm-hmm.
Jamestown and Virginia, early Virginia, was not the place where American exceptionalism was born. I know Virginians hate to hear this, but it was Plymouth. And the reason for that is that the Pilgrims arrived at Plymouth with what we call in our book, A Patriot's History of the United States, the four pillars of American exceptionalism. And the first two are what are critical here, and that is a Christian, mostly Protestant, religious tradition, which was bottom up in its congregational structure, unlike the Anglicans who settled in Virginia, unlike the Catholics who settled in Canada. And people say, well, I can't believe this is happening in Canada and Australia and New Zealand. Aren't they free countries? Well, no, they don't have the same pillars of exceptionalism we do because they were all founded by top-down religions, either Anglican or Catholic, and or, number two pillar, they don't have common law. Common law is the notion that God puts a law in the hearts of the people and they elect or select leaders who enforce or carry out that law.
Amen. Yeah.
And the dominions, both Canada and Australia and New Zealand, all of the dominions, even those in Africa, were not treated like common law countries. Even though England had common law, they treated them like dominions and it was top-down governance. So in those two ways, Canada, Australia, New Zealand have nothing whatsoever in common with America.
Larry Schweikert is on with us. UncoverDC.com is his daily website, and I've just been catching up on it. The book is Dragon Slayers. It's a President's Day special, and I usually rail at President's Day saying, well, when do we have Congress People's Day? When do we have Supreme Court Justices Day? Because as I've read the Constitution, and my friends in Orange County always bristle when I say, you know, the two kids from Charlottesville changed the world, Jefferson and Madison, and they say, Madison was from Orange. I said, it's the metropolitan area. They're counted in my ratings. So, you know, he's part of the Charlottesville metro area. Never mind, you know, James Monroe and his ability to get the Bill of Rights tacked on, because he really was, in many cases, the peacemaker between Patrick Henry and James Madison over the Constitution.
Yes.
And then, of course, Donald Trump's family owns a winery here, so you could say we need a fourth so room for a fourth silhouette on a wall. You talk about the swamp and what it's done to these folks, and yet, you know, fits and starts, Kennedy, and Lincoln, Trump, Reagan, you know, at the end of the day, the swamp just gets deeper and muckier.
Right. And so I've divided the book into the successes and failures. And for the most part, Lincoln was a success. He fought his swamp, which was the slave power conspiracy, and beat it. Cleveland was pretty much a success. He didn't totally defeat the spoil system, but he set it back a number of years. And Teddy Roosevelt was pretty successful at fighting the industrial swamp. Where Roosevelt failed, and this is what people don't understand, he launched his antitrust work against corporations largely because he feared the media, the news of the day. He thought that the media was going to spark a class war against the corporations that would lead to basically socialization. And in his mind, he was saving the corporations from the people as inspired by the media. And so where Roosevelt's big failure comes is he never saw that the media itself would become the swamp and a major part of the trust that he was fighting. And then I have the three failures, which are Kennedy and Reagan and Trump. Not that they didn't try, but Kennedy needed the CIA too much for what he was doing in the Cold War to really disestablish them. Reagan came in with three major goals, one to defeat the Soviets, one to rebuild the economy, and then one to cut government. And the other two just simply took too much out of him. Mm-hmm. There wasn't enough time in the day to do all three. And then Trump, of course, the deck was so totally stacked against him that once they got Sessions out of the way, they had free reign.
Yeah, Larry Schweikert on with us. Hang on, I want to talk about William Randolph Hearst and that media breakup, too, in a moment. Joe Thomas in the morning.
Like us. Follow us. Just don't touch that dial.
What is it, hot? Apple.
Charlottesville's homepage, Seville 107.5 and 1260 WCHV.
Larry, let me ask you this, and you brought up Roosevelt, and I wrote the note while I was listening to you talk to Charlie Kirk the other day. I said, I want to talk to him more about Roosevelt, because you talk about William Randolph Hearst and the power he had. I mean, he almost single-handedly used, ironically, Cosmopolitan magazine to get the U.S. Senate changed from a representative of the states to to just a super legislator in populist form. Didn't even change the term of office, which was, as I read it in the Federalist Papers, designed to outstrip a governor's term who would have appointed them. And all the things that were written into how the Senate was supposed to work, Hearst was able to just blow up with his media power. But you look at, you know, some of the trust busting Roosevelt did. I mean, we're one merger away from having Standard Oil back together, but the banking trusts now, you know, seem to be somebody, right? You know, we need to look at, you know, Bank of America and Wells Fargo pretty much run almost all the banking. And you mentioned Canada. How easy would it be with the regulatory state be able to do what Governor Cuomo did in New York and unbank anyone who wants to, let's say, buy a firearm?
Right. No, it's getting very, very dangerous. And I read something the other day that, you know, five companies own 70% of this industry and seven companies own 80% of that industry. It's across the board. But right now, I think the biggest concern has to be the media, because people always, free marketeers, and Milton Friedman would always say, well, you know, if you don't like it, start your own. Well, that's not possible anymore. Nobody can start a Google. Nobody can start a Yahoo. Nobody can start a Facebook or Twitter. Trump's truth is going to be a very interesting test case, because as much power and leverage as he has, we'll see if that can, in fact, pull away from Twitter and Facebook. But there definitely need to be antitrust legislation launched against all of the big corporate media outlets. And then, you know, this is another issue. My wife is always saying, well, what happens when they don't have any viewers? What happens when CNN doesn't have any viewers?
Doesn't seem to matter.
Almost where it is now. I think my daily Uncovered DC feed has as many people watching it as they do. But it doesn't matter. You're right. It doesn't matter, because General Electric or whoever owns each of these big media conglomerates, Time Warner and so forth, they have so many other places where they can defray that cost. It doesn't need to be profitable.
Right. It's almost like sponsors are there just to say they're there. And that goes to another, you know, the woke investiture, the woke Wall Street. Somebody, you know, might be very much into investing in Donald Trump's efforts, but they don't want to be doxxed the way even the contributors to the Canadian truckers were. And all of a sudden, there's a website dedicated to Joe Thomas gave money to truth.com. Protest him. Take, you know, and a lot of these companies, they're still squeamish about that kind of bad PR.
Correct. And this there's, you know, we could go on for hours about how the corporations
don't tempt me.
Got woke. And it's a long story. And it's, I think, heavily driven by the marketing departments. And a lot of CEOs are just cowards and won't tell their own marketing departments, you know, flake off. We don't need you. And we're not going to do what you say. I mean, you can look at the ads today, which are an insult to any American. If you came down here from Mars and you watched just 1 hour of television with the ads, you'd conclude the United States was 99% black, 78% female, that there was no such thing as a white male who had any competence or sense whatsoever. It's sure. It's outrageous what they've done with this. And, you know, of course, I shut it off the minute I start seeing anything like that. So they aren't selling me anything.
Well, but isn't the, you know, some of it, you listen to a Bill Maher and all of a sudden, you know, almost was it Wiesel who wrote the poem, you know, first they came for the trade unionists. Mm-hmm. You know, you're starting to see this amongst the mm-hmm. left, and some of their propagandists like Bill Maher are starting to say, whoa, hang on a second here.
Yeah.
Seville 107.5 and 1260 Heart Healthy Listening for Central Virginia. WCHV is not intended to treat any actual medical conditions and should be listened to in conjunction with a well-balanced diet. Consult your physician before turning away from WCHV.
In order to form a more perfect union, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
We
Joe Thomas in the morning, President's Day, visiting with Larry Schweikert. The book is Dragon Slayer, Six Presidents Who Tried with Varying Success on Fighting the Swamp. Larry, you were talking about Roosevelt and busting up the centralized businesses, but not the media. He missed, you know, what was growing under William Randolph Hearst and the Hearst Syndicate. And then, you know, he uses his power, ironically, through Cosmopolitan magazine, to change the entire construct of the Senate and turn them into just super populists rather than just the two-year populists in the House. Now we have six-year populists, super legislators in the Senate, and that kind of thing. But it continues today with social media. We're all talking about Zuckerberg and you know, his power and his NGOs that are influencing the elections. But then it's social media that's actually showing us what's really happening in Ottawa rather than the media, and the cancel culture becomes really, you know, it's interesting how the left has become the censors, whereas it used to be, I guess, the right would be considered back in Lenny Bruce's day. And now it's the leftists, like Schlichter tweeted earlier. It's funny how the left is the ones up in arms about workers of the world uniting.
Right. And it is kind of interesting that probably because of the censorship and because of the crackdown, all the humor now, all the memes, all the comedy, all the jokes are on the right. It's conservatives now who have all the funny stuff, all the comedies. Oh, yeah. And the left are these puritanical, stuck up, masculopathic, vaxiopathic Nimrods who are just walking around pretending to be holier than thou. It's really kind of a funny inversion.
Yeah, it was. So that last one for you, Larry Schweikert, and it's Dragon Slayers. I've made the case that if you just stopped bribing all the organizations, whether it be a police department, a board of education, with all the federal money, if you just said that's it, because I think we're heading towards an economic problem that stuff's going to get weird. And they may be forced to stop sending money to your local school board and your local police department to comply with the Department of Justice, Department of Education, all of these executive branch bureaucracies that have no constitutional basis. Anyway, but we were told, and I have a piece of paper, that University of Virginia Hospital told all of their employees, get the jab or lose your job, not because of the science, but they said in the letter, because we don't want to lose out on millions of dollars in federal funding. So the mm-hmm. bribery scheme seems to be where, if you look at the $30 trillion we're in debt, it's got to have gone down a lot of that rabbit hole. If we just stop doing that for a year and see what happens and let the states figure out how to fund their own schools and the local governments and actually go back to some sort of equilibrium. Couldn't a president do that if they came in and said, this is Congress hasn't passed a budget since 2009, so I'm just going to start cutting stuff.
Well, and that's a big issue because, as you may recall, Nixon tried to impound funds and say, no, we don't want to spend that. And the Supreme Court said, no, you got to do that. If Congress is I forget which is which, authorized and allocated, but they've given the money and they said, you got to spend it this way. You have to spend it this way. And this is what I say in the book, that Reagan, it's also in my biography of Reagan called Reagan, the American President. Reagan had great trouble that once he even got his appointees in place, they started spending that money. And Stockman says, hey, we want to cut your budget. Well, you know, I've already spent the whole budget and 10% more.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I was on my way to ask you for a few more dollars. What do you mean cut it? No.
So I think what you may see is the confluence of cultural and social issues pushing that separation. Now, here in Arizona, we have charter schools. So if you want out of the public school, you can get out anytime you want. But you're going to see this business with the transgenders coming in. And sooner or later, it's going to get into the high schools. And sooner or later, parents are going to go, no, I'm not going to do that. I want my girl in women's sports, girls sports, not mixed men's sports. And so I think you'll start to see whether it's CRT, communist racist theory, or whether it's the transoid movement, or whether it's any of these things. I think the cultural issues are going to start driving people to say, reject the federal money. We want control of our schools.
Well, I appreciate your work, Larry. I had not come across it until you were on with Charlie. Yet another reason I'm glad I chose Charlie. I know we just lost Rush a year ago and the anniversary of it, but it was a tough sled, and I'm glad you're on with him. And I know I said the other one was the last one, but you know I do this sometimes. You know, a little bit. New York City public school kid. Apparently went to high school with Eric Adams. Didn't know that. Also went to school with Jordan Belfort. Didn't know that either, but it's quite Bayside. Go Commodores! But New York City Public.
I would go with Belfort before Eric the Red Adams.
I didn't know. Somebody just told me this the other day. The history of collapsing countries is not good, even Vlad the Invader in Russia came to power after chaos ensued when the Soviet Union collapsed and came to power and said, "I will restore normalcy." Napoleon. I mean, time we see rule of man over rule of law and an economic collapse, it ain't good, Larry.
No, that's exactly the concern here. And I've talked about it for over 2 years, is that Trump was, unless he comes back, Trump was our last shot at a truly elected leader, because the left will push things so far that ordinary suburban Karens are going to be screaming for somebody far worse than Trump just to get these people under control. Now, let me just mention one last thing. You said you hadn't come across me. You've got to know the book, A Patriot's History of the United States. This is the number one best-selling conservative textbook, History of the United States. It's about 900 pages long, so we don't leave anything out. But Mike Allen and I wrote this in 2004. It was a New York Times number one bestseller for over a month. It's got 500,000 copies in print. We are going into our 30th printing now.
Oh, my gosh.
I see the picture of Tom Brady reading it as well. To be fair, I was doing Top 40 radio in 2004. I was more interested in the Osbournes than the Bushes at the time.
It's like your radio is wearing a Let's Go Brandon t-shirt.
Let's go Brandon, I agree.
Seville 107.5 and 1260 WCHV.